Rackers held many surprises. The smell of mock orange was powerful here at the edge of the Daris Balat roof garden, overriding all other odours. "Never believe that you have plumbed the depths of any place, or of any human," she reminded herself. Conversation was ended out here, but not the echoes of the spoken thoughts they had exchanged only minutes ago. All agreed, though, that it was time for action. Soon, Shiana would dance a worm for them, and once more demonstrate her mastery. Waf and a new priestly representative would share this holy event, but Terraza was sure neither of them knew the real nature of what they were about to witness. Waf bore watching, of course. He still carried that air of irritated disbelief in everything he saw or heard. It was a strange mixture with his underlying awe at being on Rackers. The catalyst was obviously his rage over the fact that fools ruled here. Odraid returned from the meeting room and stopped beside Terraza.
"I am extremely disquieted by the reports from Gamu," Terraza said. "Do you bring something new?"
"No, things are obviously still chaotic there."
"Tell me, Dar, what do you think we should do?"
"I keep remembering the tyrant's words to Chenoweth. The Bene Gesserit are so close to what they should be, yet so far."
Terraza pointed at the open desert beyond the museum city's Kanat.
"He's still out there, Dar. I'm sure of it."
Terraza turned to face Odraid.
"And Shiana speaks to him."
"He told so many lies," Odraid said.
"But he didn't lie about his own incarnation. Remember what he said. Every descendant part of me will carry some of my awareness locked away within it, lost and helpless. Pearls of me moving blindly in the sand, caught in an endless dream."
"You bank a great deal on your belief in the power of that dream," Odraid said.
"We must recover the tyrant's design. All of it."
Odraid sighed, but did not speak.
"Never underestimate the power of an idea," Terraza said. "The Atreides were ever philosophers in their governance. Philosophy is always dangerous because it promotes the creation of new ideas."
Still, Odraid did not respond.
"The worm carries it all within him, Dar. All of the forces he set in motion are still in him."
"Are you trying to convince me or yourself, Tar?"
"I am punishing you, Dar, just as the tyrant is still punishing us."
"For not being what we should be? Ah, here comes Shiana and the others."
"The worm's language, Dar. That is the important thing."
"If you say so, Mother Superior."
Terraza sent an angry stare at Odraid, who moved forward to greet the newcomers. There was a disturbing gloom in Odraid. The presence of Shiana, though, restored Terraza's sense of purpose. An alert little thing, Shiana. Very good material. Shiana had demonstrated her dance the previous night, performing in the great museum room against a tapestry background, an exotic dance against an exotic spice fibre hanging with its image of desert and worms. She appeared to be almost a part of the hanging, a figure projected forward from the stylized dunes and their elaborately detailed coursing worms. Terraza recalled how Shiana's brown hair had been thrown outward by the whirling movements of the dance, swinging in a fuzzy arc. Sidelighting accented the reddish glints in her hair. Her eyes had been closed, but it was not a face in repose. Excitement betrayed itself in the passionate set of her wide mouth, the flaring of her nostrils, the forward thrust of her chin. Her motions had conveyed an inner sophistication that belied her youth.
"The dance is her language," Terraza thought. "Odraid is correct. Seeing it, we will learn it."
Waf had something of a withdrawn look this morning. It was difficult to determine if his eyes were looking outward or inward. With Waf was Talushan, a darkly handsome Rakian, the priesthood's chosen representative at today's holy event. Terraza, meeting him at the demonstration dance, had found it extraordinary how Talushan never needed to say "but," and yet the word was always there in everything he uttered. A perfect bureaucrat. He rightly expected to go far, but those expectations would soon encounter their ultimate surprise. She felt no pity for him at this knowledge. Talushan was a soft-faced youth, of too few standards for such a position of trust. There was more to him than met the eye, of course. And less. Waf moved to one side in the garden, leaving Odraid and Shiana with Talushan. The young priest was expendable, naturally. That explained much about why he had been chosen for this venture. It told her that she had achieved the proper level of potential violence. Terraza did not think, though, that any of the priestly factions would dare harm Shiana.
We will stay close to Shiana.
They had spent a busy week since the demonstration of the whore's sexual accomplishments. A very disturbing week, when it came to that. Odraid had been kept busy with Shiana. Terraza would have preferred Lucilla for this educational chore, but she made do with what was available, and Odraid obviously was the best available on Rakkis for such teaching. Terraza looked back toward the desert. They were waiting for the Thopters from Keen with their cargoes of very important observers. The VIOs were not yet late, but crowding it as such people always did. Shiana seemed to be taking the sexual education well, although Terraza's estimation of the Sisterhood's available teaching males on Rakkis was not high. Her first night here, Terraza had called in one of the servant males. Afterward, she had judged it too much trouble for the little joy and forgetfulness it provided. Besides, what was there to forget? To forget was to allow a weakness.
Never forget.
That's what the whores did, though. They traded in forgetfulness, and they had not the least awareness of the tyrant's continuing, vice-like hold on human destiny, nor of the need to break that hold. Terraza had listened, secretly, to the previous day's session between Shiana and Odraid.
What was I listening for?
Young girl and teacher had been out here in the roof garden, facing each other on two benches, a portable Ixion damper hiding their words from anyone who did not have the coded translator. The suspensor boy damper hovered between the two like a strange umbrella, a black disc projecting distortions that hid the precise movements of lips and the sounds of voices. To Terraza, standing within the long meeting room, the tiny translator in her left ear, the lesson had occurred like an equally distorted memory.
When I was taught these things, we had not seen what the whores of the scattering could do. Why do you say it's the complexity of sex? Shiana asked. The man you sent last night kept saying that. Many believe they understand it, Shiana. Perhaps no one has ever understood it, because such words require more of the mind than they do of the flesh. Why must I not use any of the things we saw the face dancers do? Shiana, complexity hides within complexity. Great deeds and foul ones have been done at the goading of sexual forces. We speak of sexual strength and sexual energies and such things as the overmounting urge of desire. I don't deny that such things are observable, but what we are looking at here is a force so powerful that it can destroy you and everything you hold worthwhile. That's what I'm trying to understand. What is it the whores are doing wrong? They ignore the species at its work, Shiana. I think you can already sense this. The tyrant certainly knew about it. What was his golden path but a vision of sexual forces at work, recreating humankind endlessly? And the whores don't create? They mostly try to control their worlds with this force. They seem to be doing that. Ah, but what counter forces do they call forth?
I don't understand.
You know about voice and how it can control some people, but not control everybody?
Exactly.
A civilization subjected to voice over a long period develops ways of adapting to this force, preventing manipulation by those who use voice.
So there are people who know how to resist the whores?
We see unmistakable signs of it, and that is one of the reasons we are here on Rakkis.
Will the whores come here?
I'm afraid so. They want to control the core of the old empire, because they see us as an easy conquest.
Aren't you afraid they'll win?
They won't win, Shiana. Depend on it. But they are good for us.
How is that?
Shiana's tone echoed Terraza's own shock at hearing such words from Odraid.
How much did Odraid suspect?
In the next instant, Terraza understood, and she wondered if the lesson was equally understandable to the young girl.
The core is static, Shiana. We have been almost at a standstill for thousands of years. Life and movement are out there with the people of the scattering who resist the whores. Whatever we do, we must make that resistance even stronger.
The sound of approaching Thopters broke Terraza from her reverie of remembrance. The VIOs were arriving from Keen. Still at some distance, but the sound carried far in the clear air. Odraid's teaching method was a good one, Terraza had to admit as she scanned the sky for a first glimpse of the Thopters. Apparently they were coming in low and from the other side of the building. That was the wrong direction, but perhaps they had taken the VIOs on a short excursion over the remains of the Tyrant's Wall. Many people were curious about the place where Odraid had found the spice hoard. Shiana, Odraid, Waff, and Talushan went back into the long meeting room. They had heard the Thopters too. Shiana was anxious to show her power over the worms. Terraza hesitated. There was a laboring sound in the approaching Thopters. Were they overloaded? How many observers had they brought? The first Thopter lifted over the penthouse roof, and Terraza saw the armored cockpit. She recognized treachery even before the first beam arced out of the machine, slicing through her legs below the knees. She fell heavily against a potted tree, her legs completely severed. Another beam slashed out at her, slicing at an angle across her hip. The Thopter swept over her in an abrupt roar of booster jets and banked away to the left. Terraza clung to the tree, shunting the agony aside. She managed to cut off most of the blood flow from her wounds, but the pain was great. Not as great as the spice agony, though, she reminded herself. That helped, but she knew she was doomed. She heard shouts and the multiple sounds of violence all around the museum now. I have won, Terraza thought. Odraid darted from the penthouse and bent over Terraza. They said nothing, but Odraid showed that she understood by putting her forehead to Terraza's temple. It was the ages-old cue of the Bene Gesserit. Terraza began pouring her life into Odraid. Other memories, hopes, fears, everything. One of them might yet escape. Shiana watched from the penthouse, staying where she had been ordered to wait. She knew what was happening out there in the roof garden. This was the ultimate mystery of the Bene Gesserit, and every postulant was aware of it. Waff and Talushan, already out of the room when the attack came, did not return. Shiana shuddered with apprehension. Abruptly, Odraid stood and ran back into the penthouse. There was a wild look in her eyes, but she moved with purpose. Leaping up, she gathered glow globes, grabbing them in bundles by their toggle cords. She thrust several bundles into Shiana's hands, and Shiana felt her body grow lighter with the lift of the globe's suspensor fields. Trailing more clusters of the globes beyond their field range, Odraid hurried across to the narrow end of the room where a grill in the wall indicated what she sought. With Shiana's help, she lifted the grill out of its slots, revealing a deep air shaft. The light of the clustered glow globes showed rough walls inside. Hold the globes close to get the maximum field effect, Odraid said. Push them away to lower yourself. In you go. Shiana clutched the toggle cords in a sweaty hand and hopped over the sill. She let herself fall, then fearfully clutched the globes close. Light from above told her Odraid was following. At the bottom they emerged into a pump room, the susurrations of many fans a background for the sounds of violence from outside. We must get to the no room and then to the desert, Odraid said. All of these machinery systems are interconnected. There will be a passage. Is she dead? Shiana whispered. Yes.
Poor Mother Superior.
I am the Mother Superior now, Shiana, at least temporarily. She pointed upward. Those were the whores attacking us. We must hurry.
The world is for the living. Who are they? We dared the dark to reach the white and warm. She was the wind when the wind was in my way. Alive at noon I perished in her form. Who rise from the flesh to spirit know the fall. The word outleaps the world, and light is all. Theodore Retke. Historical Quotations, Dar es Balad. It required little conscious volition for Teg to become the whirlwind. He had recognized at last the nature of the threat from the Honored Matres. Recognition fitted itself into the blurred requirements made upon him by the new Mentat awareness that went with his magnified speed. Monstrous threat required monstrous countermeasures. Blood spattered him as he drove himself through the headquarters building, slaughtering everyone he met. As he had learned from his Bene Gesserit teachers, the great problem of the human universe lay in how you managed procreation. He could hear the voice of his first teacher as he carried destruction through the building. You may think of this only as sexuality, but we prefer the more basic term, procreation. It has many facets and offshoots, and it has apparently unlimited energy. The emotion called love is only one small aspect. Teg crushed the throat of a man standing rigidly in his path and, at last, found the control room for the building's defences. Only one man was seated in it, his right hand almost touching a red key on the console in front of him. With a slashing left hand, Teg almost decapitated the man, the body tipped backward in slow motion, blood welling from the gaping neck.
The Sisterhood is right to call them whores.
You could drag humankind almost anywhere by manipulating the enormous energies of procreation. You could goad humans into actions they would never have believed possible. One of his teachers had said it directly. This energy must have an outlet. Bottle it up and it becomes monstrously dangerous. Redirect it and it will sweep over anything in its path. This is an ultimate secret of all religions. Teg was conscious of leaving more than 50 bodies behind him as he left the building. The last fatality was a soldier in camouflage uniform standing in the open doorway apparently about to enter. As he ran past apparently unmoving people and vehicles, Teg's revved-up mind had time to reflect on what he had left behind him. Was there any consolation, he wondered, in the fact that the old Honored Matre's last living expression was one of real surprise? Could he congratulate himself that Muzaffar would never again see his frame bush home? The necessity for what he had accomplished in a few heartbeats was very clear, though, to one trained by the Bene Gesserit. Teg knew his history. There were many paradise planets in the old empire, probably many more among the people of the Scattering. Humans always seemed capable of trying that foolish experiment. People in such places mostly lazed along. A quick, smart analysis said this was because of the easy climates on such planets. He knew this for stupidity. It was because sexual energy was easily released in such places. Let the missionaries of the divided god or some denominational construct enter one of these paradises and you got outrageous violence. We of the Sisterhood know, one of Teg's teachers had said. We have put a flame to that fuse more than once with our Missionaria Protectiva. Teg did not stop running until he was in an alley at least 5 kilometers from the abattoir that had been the headquarters for the old Honored Matre. He knew that very little time had passed, but there was something much more important upon which he had to focus. He had not killed every occupant of that building. There were eyes back there belonging to people who knew now what he could do. They had seen him kill Honored Matres. They had seen Muzaffar topple dead at his hands. The evidence of the bodies left behind and the slowed replay of recordings would tell it all. Teg leaned against a wall. Skin was torn from his left palm. He let himself return to normal time as he watched blood oozing from the wound. The blood was almost black. More oxygen in my blood? He was panting, but not as much as these exertions would seem to require.
What has happened to me?
It was something from his Atreides ancestry, he knew. Crisis had tipped him over into another dimension of human possibilities. Whatever the transformation, it was profound. He could see outward now into many necessities, and the people he had passed on his run to this alley had seemed like statues.
Will I ever think of them as muck?
It could only happen if he let it happen, he knew. But the temptation was there, and he allowed himself a brief commiseration for the Honored Matres. Great temptation had toppled them into their own muck. What to do now? The main line lay open to him. There was a man here in Yasai, one man who would be sure to know everything Teg required. Teg looked around the alley. Yes, that man was near. The fragrance of flowers and herbs wafted to Teg from somewhere down this alley. He moved toward this fragrance, aware that it led him where he needed to go and that no violent attack awaited him here. This was, temporarily, a quiet backwater. He came to the fragrance source quickly. It was an inset doorway marked by a blue awning with two words on it in modern Galak: personal service. Teg entered and saw immediately what he had found. They were to be seen at many places in the old empire, eating establishments harking back to ancient times, eschewing automata from kitchen to table. Most of them were in establishments. You told friends about your latest discovery, with an admonition to them not to spread the word. Don't want to spoil it with crowding. This idea had always amused Teg. You spread the word about such places, but you did it under the guise of keeping a secret. Mouth-watering odours of cooking emerged from the kitchen at the rear. A waiter passed bearing a tray from which steam lifted, carrying the promise of good things. A young woman in a short black dress with a white apron came up to him.
"This way, sir. We have a table open in the corner."
She held a chair for him to be seated with his back to the wall.
"Someone will be with you in a moment, sir."
She passed him a stiff sheet of cheap, double-thickness paper.
"Our menu is printed. I hope you won't mind."
He watched her leave. The waiter he had seen passed going the other way toward the kitchen. The tray was empty. Teg's feet had led him here as though he had been running on a fixed track. And there was the man he required, dining nearby. The waiter had stopped to talk to the man Teg knew held the answer to the next moves required here. The two were laughing together. Teg scanned the rest of the room, only three other tables occupied. An older woman sat at a table in the far corner, nibbling at some frosty confection. She was dressed in what Teg thought must be the peak of current fashion, a clinging short red gown cut low at the neck. Her shoes matched. A young couple sat at a table off to his right. They saw no one except each other. An older man in a tightly fitted old-fashioned brown tunic ate sparingly of a green vegetable dish near the door. He had eyes only for his food. The man talking to the waiter laughed loudly. Teg stared at the back of the waiter's head. Tufts of blonde hair sprang from the nape of the waiter's neck like broken bunches of dead grass. The man's collar was frayed beneath the tufted hair. Teg lowered his gaze. The waiter's shoes were run over at the heels. The hem of his black jacket had been darned. Was it thrift in this place? Thrift or some other form of economic pressure? The odours from the kitchen did not suggest any stinting here. The tableware was shining and clean, no cracked dishes. But the striped red and white cloth on the table had been darned in several places, care taken to match the original fabric. Once more, Teg studied the other customers. They looked substantial. None of the starving poor in this place. Teg had it registered then. Not only was this an inn place, somebody had designed it for just that effect. There was a clever mind behind such an establishment. This was the kind of restaurant that rising young executives revealed to make points with prospective customers or to please a superior. The food would be superb and the portions generous. Teg realized that his instincts had led him here correctly. He bent his attention to the menu then, allowing hunger to enter his consciousness at last. The hunger was at least as fierce as that which had astonished the late Field Marshal Muzaffar. The waiter appeared beside him with a tray on which were placed a small open box and a jar from which wafted the pungent odour of new skin ointment.
"I see you have injured your hand, Basha," the man said.
He placed the tray on the table.
"Allow me to dress the injury before you order."
Teg lifted the injured hand and watched the swift competence of the treatment.
"You know me?"
Teg asked.
"Yes, sir. And after what I've been hearing, it seems strange to see you in full uniform."
"There." He finished the dressing.
"What have you been hearing?"
Teg spoke in a low voice.
"That the honored Matres hunt you."
"I've just killed some of them, and many of their... what should we call them?"
The man paled, but he spoke firmly.
"Slaves would be a good word, sir."
"You were at Rondatai, weren't you?"
Teg said.
"Yes, sir. Many of us settled here afterward."
"I need food, but I cannot pay you,"
Teg said.
"No one from Rondatai has need of your money, Basha. Do they know you came this way?"
"I don't believe they do."
"The people here now are regulars. None of them would betray you. I will try to warn you if someone dangerous comes. What did you wish to eat?"
"A great deal of food. I will leave the choice to you. About twice as much carbohydrate as protein. No stimulants."
"What do you mean by a great deal, sir?"
"Keep bringing it until I tell you to stop. Or until you feel I have overstepped your generosity."
"In spite of appearances, sir, this is not a poor establishment. The extras here have made me a rich man."
Score one for his assessment, Teg thought. The thrift here was a calculated pose. The waiter left and again spoke to the man at the central table. Tegg studied the man openly after the waiter went on into the kitchen. Yes, that was the man. The diner concentrated on a plate heaped with some green-garnished pasta. There was very little sign in this man of a woman's care, Tegg thought. His collar had been closed awry, the cling straps tangled. Spots on the greenish sauce soiled his left cuff. He was naturally right-handed, but ate while his left hand remained in the path of spillage. Frayed cuffs on his trousers, one trouser hem, partly released from its threaded bondage, dragged at the heel. Stockings, mismatched, one blue and one pale yellow. None of this appeared to bother him. No mother or other woman had ever dragged this one back from a doorway with orders to make himself presentable. His basic attitude was announced in his whole appearance. What you see is as presentable as it gets. The man looked up suddenly, a jerking motion as though he had been goosed. He sent a brown-eyed gaze around the room, pausing at each face in turn, as though he looked for a particular visage. This done, he returned his attention to his plate. The waiter returned with a clear soup in which shreds of egg and some green vegetables could be seen.
"Well, the rest of your meal is being prepared, sir," he said. "Did you come here directly after Rondatai?"
Tegg asked.
"Yes, sir, but I served with you also at a Klein."
"The 67th Gamu," Tegg said.
"Yes, sir."
"We saved a good many lives that time," Tegg said. "Theirs and ours."
When Tegg still did not begin eating, the waiter spoke in a rather cold voice.
"Would you require a snooper, sir?"
"Not while you're serving me," Tegg said.
He meant what he said, but he felt a bit of a fraud, because doubled vision told him the food was safe. The waiter started to turn away, pleased.
"One moment," Tegg said.
"Sir?"
"The man at that central table, he is one of your regulars?"
"Professor Delnay?"
"Oh, yes, sir."
"Delnay. Yes, I thought so."
"Professor of martial arts, sir, and the history of same."
"I know. When it comes time to serve my dessert, please ask Professor Delnay if he would join me."
"Shall I tell him who you are, sir?"
"Don't you think he already knows?"
"That would seem likely, sir, but still—"
"Caution where caution belongs," Tegg said. "Bring on the food."
Delnay's interest was fully aroused long before the waiter relayed Tegg's invitation. The professor's first words as he seated himself across from Tegg were,
"That was the most remarkable gastronomic performance I have ever seen. Are you sure you can eat dessert?"
"Two or three of them at least,"
Tegg said.
"Astonishing."
Tegg sampled a spoonful of a honey-sweetened confection. He swallowed it, then,
"This place is a jewel."
"I have kept it a careful secret," Delnay said, "except for a few close friends, of course. To what do I owe the honor of your invitation?"
"Have you ever been, marked by an honored matre?"
"Lords of perdition, no. I'm not important enough for that."
"I was hoping to ask you to risk your life, Delnay."
"In what way?"
No hesitation. That was reassuring.
"There is a place in Yasai where my old soldiers meet. I want to go there and see as many of them as possible."
"Through the streets in full regalia, the way you are now?"
"In any way you can arrange it."
Delnay put a finger to his lower lip and leaned back to stare at Tegg.
"You're not an easy figure to disguise, you know. However, there may be a way."
He nodded thoughtfully.
"Yes,"
he smiled.
"You won't like it, I'm afraid."
"What do you have in mind?"
"Some padding and other alterations. We will pass you off as a Bordano overseer. You'll smell of the sewer, of course, and you'll have to carry it off that you don't notice."
"Why do you think that will succeed?"
Tegg asked.
"Oh, there's going to be a storm tonight. Regular thing this time of year, laying down the moisture for next year's open crops and filling the reservoirs for the heated fields, you know."
"I don't understand your reasoning, but when I've finished another of these confections, we'll go,"
Tegg said.
"You'll like the place where we take refuge from the storm," Delnay said. "I'm mad, you know, to do this, but the proprietor here said I was to help you or never come here again."
It was an hour after dark when Delnay led him to the rendezvous point. Tegg, dressed in leathers and affecting a limp, was forced to use much of his mental power to ignore his own odours. Delnay's friends had plastered Tegg with sewage and then hosed him off. The forced air drying brought back most of the effluent aromas. A remote reading weather station at the door of the meeting place told Tegg it had dropped 15 degrees outside in the preceding hour.
Delnay preceded him and hurried away into the crowded room, where there was much noise and the sound of clinking glassware. Tegg paused to study the doorside station. The wind was gusting to 30 clicks, he saw, barometric pressure down. He looked at the sign above the station. A service to our customers. Presumably a service to the bar as well. Departing customers might well take one look at these readings and return to the warmth and camaraderie behind them. In a large fireplace with inglenook at the far end of the bar, there was a real fire burning. Aromatic wood. Delnay returned, wrinkled his nose at Tegg's smell, and led him around the edge of the crowd into a back room, then through this into a private bathroom. Tegg's uniform, cleaned and pressed, was laid out over a chair there. "I'll be in the inglenook when you come out," Delnay said.
"In full regalia, eh?"
Tegg asked. "It's only dangerous out in the streets," Delnay said. He went back the way they had come. Tegg emerged presently and found his way to the inglenook through groups that turned suddenly silent as people recognized him. Murmurous comments swept through the room.
"The old basher himself. Oh yes, it's Tegg. Served with him, I did. Know that face and figure anywhere."
Customers had crowded into the atavistic warmth of the fireside. There was a rich smell of wet clothing and drink-fogged breaths there. So the storm had driven this crowd into the bar? Tegg looked at the battle-hardened military faces all around him, thinking that this was not a usual gathering, no matter what Delnay said. The people here knew one another, though, and had expected to meet one another here at this time. Delnay was sitting on one of the benches in the inglenook, a glass containing an amber drink in his hand.
"You put out the word to meet us here," Tegg said.
"Isn't that what you wanted, Basha?"
"Who are you, Delnay?"
"I own a winter farm a few clicks south of here, and I have some banker friends who will occasionally loan me a ground car. If you want me to be more specific, I'm like the rest of the people in this room, someone who wants the honoured matres off our necks."
A man behind Tegg asked,
"Is it true that you killed 100 of them today, Basha?"
Tegg spoke dryly without turning.
"The number is greatly exaggerated. Could I have a drink, please?"
From his greater height, Tegg scanned the room while someone was getting him a glass. When it was thrust into his hand, it was, as he expected, the deep blue of Danyan Merinet. These old soldiers knew his preferences. The drinking activity in the room continued, but at a more subdued pace. They were waiting for him to state his purpose. Gregarious human nature got a natural boost on such a stormy night, Tegg thought. "Band together behind the fire in the mouth of the cave, fellow tribesmen. Nothing dangerous will get past us, especially when the beasts see our fire." How many other similar gatherings were there around Gamu on such a night, he wondered, sipping his drink. Bad weather could mask movements that the gathered companions did not want observed. The weather might also keep certain people inside who were otherwise not supposed to remain inside. He recognized a few faces from his past, officers and ordinary soldiers, a mixed bag. For some of them, he had good memories, reliable people. Some of them would die tonight. The noise level began to increase as people relaxed in his presence. No one pressed him for an explanation. They knew that about him, too. Tegg set his own timetable. The sounds of conversation and laughter were of a kind he knew must have accompanied such gatherings since the dawn times when humans clustered for mutual protection. Clinking of glassware, sudden bursts of laughter, a few quiet chuckles. Those would be the ones more conscious of their personal power. Quiet chuckles said you could be amused, but you did not have to make a guffawing fool of yourself. Delnay was a quiet chuckler. Tegg glanced up and saw that the beamed ceiling had been built conventionally low. It made the enclosed space seem at once more extended and yet more intimate. Careful attention to human psychology here. It was a thing he had observed many places on this planet. It was a care to keep a damper on unwanted awareness, make them feel comfortable and secure. They were not, of course, but don't let that get through to them. For a few moments longer, Tegg watched the drinks being distributed by the skilled waiting staff. Dark local beers and some expensive imports. Scattered along the bar and on the softly illuminated tables were bowls containing crisp fried local vegetables, heavily salted. Such an obvious move to heighten thirst apparently offended no one. It was merely expected in this trade.
The beers would be heavily salted, too, of course. They always were. Brewers knew how to kick off the thirst response. Some of the groups were getting louder. The drinks had begun to work their ancient magic. Bacchus was here. Teg knew that if this gathering were allowed to run its natural course, the room would reach a crescendo later in the night, and then gradually, very gradually, the noise level would subside. Someone would go look at the Dorside weather station. Depending on what that one saw, the place might wind down immediately or continue at the more subdued pace for some time. He realized then that somewhere behind the bar there would be a way to distort the weather station's readouts. This bar would not overlook such a way of extending its trade.
Get him inside and keep him here by any means they don't find objectionable.
The people behind this institution would fall in with the honored matres and not blink an eye. Teg put his drink aside and called out,
"May I have your attention, please?"
Silence. Even the waiting staff stopped in what they were doing.
"Some of you guard the doors," Teg said. "No one goes in or out until I give the order. Those back doors, too, if you please."
When this had been sorted out, he stared carefully around the room, picking the ones his doubled vision and old military experience told him could be most trusted. What he had to do now had become quite plain to him. Was Marley, Lucilla, and Duncan were out there at the edge of his new vision, their needs easily seen.
"I presume you can get your hands on weapons rather quickly," he said.
"We came prepared, Basha,"
someone out in the room shouted. Teg heard the drink in that voice, but also the old adrenaline pumping that would be so dear to these people.
"We are going to capture a no-ship,"
Teg said. That grabbed them. No other artifact of civilization was as closely guarded. These ships came to the landing fields and other places, and they left. Their armored surfaces bristled with weapons. Crews were on constant alert in vulnerable locations. Trickery might succeed, open assault stood little chance, but here in this room Teg had reached a new awareness, driven by necessity and the wild genes in his Atreides ancestry. The positions of the no-ships on and around Gamu were visible to him. Bright dots occupied his inner vision, and like threads leading from one bauble to another, his doubled vision saw the way through this maze.
"Oh, but I do not want to go," he thought.
The thing driving him would not be denied.
"Specifically, we are going to capture a no-ship from the Scattering," he said. "They are some of the best. You, you and you and you," he pointed, singling out individuals. "You will stay here and see that no one leaves or communicates with anyone outside of this establishment. I think you will be attacked. Hold out as long as you can. The rest of you, get your weapons and let's go."
Justice? Who asks for justice? We make our own justice. We make it here on Arrakis, win or die. Let us not rail about justice as long as we have arms and the freedom to use them. Leto II, Bene Gesserit Archives. The no-ship came in low over the Rakian sands. Its passage stirred up dusty whirlwinds that drifted around it as it settled in a crunching disturbance of the dunes. The silvered yellow sun was sinking into a horizon disturbed by the heat devils of a long, hot day. The no-ship sat there creaking, a glistening, steely ball whose presence could be detected by the eyes and ears, but not by any prescient or long-range instrument. Teg's doubled vision made him confident that no unwanted eyes saw his arrival.
"I want the armored thopters and cars out there in no more than 10 minutes, he said.
People stirred into action behind him.
"Are you certain they're here, Basha?"
The voice was that of a drinking companion from the Gamu bar, a trusted officer from Rondatai whose mood no longer was that of someone recapturing the thrills of his youth. This one had seen old friends die in the battle on Gamu. As with most of the others who survived to come here, he had left a family whose fate he did not know. There was a touch of bitterness in his voice, as though he were trying to convince himself that he had been tricked into this venture.
"They will be here soon," Teg said. "They will arrive riding on the back of a worm."
"How do you know that?"
"It was all arranged."
Teg closed his eyes. He did not need eyes to see the activity all around him. This was like so many command posts he had occupied, an oval room of instruments and people who operated them, officers waiting to obey. What is this place? Someone asked.
Those rocks to the north of us, Teg said. See them? They were a high cliff once. It was called Wind Trap. There was a Fremen sietch there, little more than a cave now. A few Rakian pioneers live in it.
Fremen, someone whispered. Gods, I want to see that worm coming. I never thought I'd ever see such a thing.
Another one of your unexpected arrangements, eh? Asked the officer of the growing bitterness.
What would he say if I revealed my new abilities? Teg wondered.
He might think I concealed purposes that would not bear close examination. And he would be right. That man is on the edge of a revelation. Would he remain loyal if his eyes were opened?
Teg shook his head. The officer would have little choice. None of them had much choice except to fight and die. It was true, Teg thought then, that the process of arranging conflicts involved the hoodwinking of large masses. How easy it was to fall into the attitude of the honored Matres.
Muck.
The hoodwinking was not as difficult as some supposed. Most people wanted to be led. That officer back there had wanted it. There were deep tribal instincts, powerful unconscious motivations to account for this. The natural reaction when you began to recognize how easily you were led was to look for scapegoats. That officer back there wanted a scapegoat now.
Basmali wants to see you, someone off to Teg's left said.
Not now, Teg said.
Basmali could wait. He would have his day of command soon enough. Meanwhile, he was a distraction. There would be time later for him to skirt dangerously near the role of scapegoat. How easy it was to produce scapegoats and how readily they were accepted. This was especially true when the alternative was to find yourself either guilty or stupid or both. Teg wanted to say, for all of those around him,
look to the hoodwinking, then you'll know our true intentions.
The communications officer on Teg's left said,
That Reverend Mother is with Basmali now. She insists they be allowed in to see you.
Tell Basmali I want him to go back and stay with Duncan, Teg said, and have him look in on Mabella. Make sure she's secured. Lucilla can come in.
It had to be, Teg thought. Lucilla was increasingly suspicious about the changes in him. Trust a Reverend Mother to see the difference. Lucilla swept in, her robes swishing to accent her vehemence. She was angry, but concealing it well.
I demand an explanation, Miles.
That was a good opening line, he thought.
Of what?
He said.
Why didn't we just go in at the...
Because the honored Matres and their Tleilaxu companions from the scattering hold most of the Rakian centers.
How? How do you...
They've killed Taraza, you know,
he said. That stopped her. But not for long.
Miles, I insist that you tell me...
We don't have much time, he said. The next satellite passage will show us on the surface here.
But the defenses of Rakis...
Are as vulnerable as any other defenses when they become static, he said. The families of the defenders are down here. Take the families, and you have effective control of the defenders.
But why are we out here in...
To pick up Odraid and that girl with her. Oh, and their worm, too.
What will we do with a...
Odraid will know what to do with a worm. She's your mother superior now, you know.
So you're going to whisk us off into...
You'll whisk yourselves. My people and I will remain to create a diversion.
That brought a shocked silence throughout the command station.
Diversion, Teg thought. What an inadequate word.
The resistance he had in mind would create hysteria among the honored Matres, especially when they were made to believe the Golo was here. Not only would they counterattack, they eventually would resort to sterilization procedures. Most of Rakis would become a charred ruin. There was little likelihood that any humans, worms, or sand trout would survive.
The honored Matres have been trying to locate and capture a worm without success, he said. I really don't understand how they could be so blind in their concept of how you transplant one of them.
Transplant?
Lucilla was floundering. Teg had seldom seen a Reverend Mother at such a loss. She was trying to assemble the things he had said. The Sisterhood had some of the Mentat's capabilities, he had observed. A Mentat could come to a qualified conviction without sufficient data. He thought that he would be long out of her reach, or the reach of any other Reverend Mother, before she assembled this data. Then there would be a scrambling for his offspring. They would pick up Demela for their breeding mistresses, of course, and Odraid. She would not escape.
They had the key to the Tleilaxu axolotl tanks, too. It would be only a matter of time now until the Bene Gesserit overcame its scruples and mastered that source of the spice. A human body produced it.
"We're in danger here, then," Lucilla said.
"Some danger, yes. The trouble with the Honored Matres is that they're too wealthy. They make the mistakes of the wealthy."
"Depraved whores," she said.
"I suggest you get to the entry port," he said. "Odraid will be here soon."
She left him without another word.
"Armory's all out and deployed," the communications officer said.
"Alert Busmali to be ready for command here," Teg said. "The rest of us will be going out soon."
"You expect all of us to join you?"
That was the one who looked for a scapegoat.
"I am going out," Teg said. "I will go alone if necessary. Only those who wish need join me."
After that, all of them would come, he thought. Peer pressure was little understood by anyone except those trained by the Bene Gesserit. It grew silent in the command station except for the faint hummings and clicks of instruments. Teg fell to thinking about the depraved whores. It was not correct to call them depraved, he thought. Sometimes the supremely rich did become depraved. That came from believing that money, power, could buy anything and everything, and why shouldn't they believe this? They saw it happening every day. It was easy to believe in absolutes.
"Hope springs eternal, and all of that gawnaw."
It was like another faith. Money would buy the impossible. Then came depravity. It was not the same for the Honored Matres. They were somehow beyond depravity. They had come through it, he could see that. But now they were into something else, so far beyond depravity that Teg wondered if he really wanted to know about it. The knowledge was there, though, inescapable in his new awareness. Not one of those people would hesitate an instant before consigning an entire planet to torture, if that meant personal gain, or if the payoff were some imagined pleasure, or if the torture produced even a few more days or hours of living. What pleased them? What gratified? They were like Semuta addicts. Whatever simulated pleasure for them, they required more of it every time.
And they know this.
How they must rage inside, caught in such a trap. They had seen it all, and none of it was enough. Not good enough, nor evil enough. They had entirely lost the knack of moderation. They were dangerous, though, and perhaps he was wrong about one thing. Perhaps they no longer remembered what it had been like before the awful transformation of that strange, tart-smelling stimulant that painted orange in their eyes. Memories of memories could become distorted. Every Mentat was sensitized to this flaw in himself.
"There's the worm!"
It was the communications officer. Teg swiveled in his chair and looked at the projection, a miniature hollow of the exterior to the southwest. The worm with its two tiny dots of human passengers was a distant sliver of wriggling movement.
"Bring Odraid in here alone when they arrive," he said. "Shiana, that's the young girl, will remain behind to help herd that worm into the hold. It will obey her. Be sure Busmali is standing ready nearby. We won't have much time for the transfer of command."
When Odraid entered the command station, she was still breathing hard and exuding the smells of the desert, a compound of melange, flint, and human perspiration. Teg sat in his chair, apparently resting. His eyes remained closed. Odraid thought she had caught the Basha in an uncharacteristic attitude of repose, almost pensive. He opened his eyes then, and she saw the change, about which Lucilla had only been able to blurt a small warning, along with a few hasty words about the Gola's transformation. What was it that had happened to Teg? He was almost posing for her, daring her to see it in him. The chin was firm, and held slightly upthrust in his normal attitude of observation. The narrow face with its webwork of age lines had lost none of its alertness. The long, thin nose, so characteristic of the Corinos and Atreides in his ancestry, had grown a bit longer with advancing years, but the grey hair remained thick and that small peak at the forehead centered the observing gaze.
On his eyes. "How did you know to meet us here?" Odraid demanded. "We had no idea where the worm was taking us."
"There are very few inhabited places here in the Meridian Desert," he said. "Gambler's choice. This seemed likely."
Gambler's choice?
She knew the Mentat phrase, but had never understood it.
Teg lifted himself from his chair.
"Take this ship and go to the place you know best," he said.
"Chapter House?" She almost said it, but thought of the others around her, these military strangers Teg had assembled. Who were they? Lucilla's brief explanation did not satisfy.
"We changed Taraz's design somewhat," Teg said. "The Gola does not stay. He must go with you."
She understood. They would need Duncan Idaho's new talents to counter the whores. He was no longer merely bait for the destruction of Rakkis.
"He will not be able to leave the no-ship's concealment, of course," Teg said.
She nodded. Duncan was not shielded from prescient searchers, such as the Guild navigators.
"Basha!"
It was the communications officer. "We've been bleeped by a satellite!"
"All right, you groundhogs," Teg shouted. "Everybody outside, get Basmali in here."
A hatch at the rear of the station flew open. Basmali lunged through.
"Basha, what are we—"
"No time, take over."
Teg lifted himself from his command chair and waved for Basmali to take it.
"Odraid here will tell you where to go."
On an impulse that he knew was partly vindictive, Teg grasped Odraid's left arm, leaned close and kissed her cheek.
"Do what you must, daughter,"
he whispered.
"That worm in the hold may soon be the only one in the universe."
Odraid saw it then. Teg knew Taraz's complete design and intended to carry out his mother superior's orders to the very end.
"Do what you must."
That said it all. We are not looking at a new state of matter, but at a newly recognized relationship between consciousness and matter, which provides a more penetrating insight into the workings of prescience. The oracle shapes a projected inner universe to produce new external probabilities out of forces that are not understood. There is no need to understand these forces before using them to shape the physical universe. Ancient metal workers had no need to understand the molecular and submolecular complexities of their steel, bronze, copper, gold, and tin. They invented mystical powers to describe the unknown while they continued to operate their forges and wield their hammers. Mother Superior Taraza, Argument in Council. The ancient structure in which the Sisterhood secreted its chapter house, its archives, and the offices of its most sacrosanct leadership did not just make sounds in the night. The noises were more like signals. Odraid had learned to read those signals over her many years here. That particular sound there, that strained creaking, was a wooden beam in the floor not replaced in some 800 years. It contracted in the night to produce those sounds. She had Taraz's memories to expand on such signals. The memories were not fully integrated. There had been very little time. Here at night in Taraz's old working room, Odraid used a few available moments to continue the integration. "Da and Ta, one at last." That was a quite identifiable Taraza comment. To haunt the other memories was to exist on several planes simultaneously, some of them very deep, but Taraza remained near the surface. Odraid allowed herself to sink farther into the multiple existences. Presently she recognized a self who was currently breathing but remote, while others demanded that she plunge into the all-enfolding visions, everything complete with smells, touches, emotions, all of the originals held intact within her own awareness. "It is unsettling to dream another's dreams." Taraza again. Taraza, who had played such a dangerous game with the future of the entire Sisterhood hanging in the balance. How carefully she had timed the leaking of word to the whores that the Tleilaxu had built dangerous abilities into the Gola, and the attack on the Gamu Keep confirmed that the information had reached its source. The brutal nature of that attack, though, had warned Taraza that she had little time. The whores would be sure to assemble forces for the total destruction of Gamo, just to kill that one Gola. So much had depended on Teg. She saw the Basha there in her own assemblage of other memories, the father she had never really known. "I didn't know him at the end, either." It could be weakening to dig into those memories, but she could not escape the demands of that luring reservoir. Odraid thought of the tyrant's words. "The terrible field of my past,
answers leap up like a frightened flock, blackening the sky of my inescapable memories. Odraid held herself like a swimmer, balanced just below the water's surface.
I most likely will be replaced, Odraid thought. I may even be reviled.
Melonda certainly was not giving easy agreement to the new state of command. No matter. Survival of the sisterhood was all that should concern any of them. Odraid floated up out of the other memories and lifted her gaze to look across the room into the shadowy niche where the bust of a woman could be discerned in the low light of the room's glow globes. The bust remained a vague shape in its shadows, but Odraid knew that face well. Chenoe, guardian symbol of Chapter House. There but for the grace of God. Every sister who came through the spice agony, as Chenoe had not, said or thought that same thing. But what did it really mean? Careful breeding and careful training produced the successful ones in sufficient numbers. Where was the hand of God in that? God certainly was not the worm they had brought from Rakkis. Was the presence of God felt only in the successes of the sisterhood? I fall prey to the pretensions of my own Missionaria Protectiva. She knew that these were similar to thoughts and questions that had been heard in this room on countless occasions. Bootless. Still, she could not bring herself to remove that guardian bust from the niche where it had reposed for so long. I am not superstitious, she told herself. I am not a compulsive person. This is a matter of tradition. Such things have a value well known to us. Certainly, no bust of me will ever be so honored. She thought of Waff and his face dancers dead with Miles Tegg in the terrible destruction of Rakkis. It did not do to dwell on the bloody attrition being suffered in the old empire. Better to think about the muscles of retribution being created by the blundering violence of the honored Matres. Tegg knew. The recently concluded council session had subsided in fatigue without firm conclusions. Odraid counted herself lucky to have diverted attention into a few immediate concerns dear to them all. The punishments. Those had occupied them for a time. Historical precedents fleshed out the archival analyses to a satisfying form. Those assemblages of humans who allied themselves with the honored Matres were in for some shocks. Ix would certainly overextend itself. They had not the slightest appreciation of how competition from the scattering would crush them. The guild would be shunted aside and made to pay dearly for its melange and its machinery. Guild and Ix, thrown together, would fall together. The fish speakers could be mostly ignored. Satellites of Ix, they were already fading into a past that humans would abandon. And the Bene Tlelaks. Ah, yes, the Tlelaksu. Waff had succumbed to the honored Matres. He had never admitted it, but the truth was plain.
Just once and with one of my own face dancers.
Odraid smiled grimly, remembering her father's bitter kiss.
I will have another niche made, she thought. I will commission another bust, Miles Tegg, the great heretic.
Lucilla's suspicions about Tegg were disquieting, though. Had he been prescient at last and able to see the no-ships? Well, the breeding mistresses could explore those suspicions.
We have lagered up, Belonda accused.
They all knew the meaning of that word. They had retreated into a fortress position for the long night of the whores. Odraid realized she did not much care for Belonda, the way she laughed occasionally to expose those wide, blunt teeth. They had discussed the cell samples from Shiana for a long time. The proof of Siona was there. She had the ancestry that shielded her from prescience and could leave the no-ship. Duncan was an unknown. Odraid turned her thoughts to the Gola out there in the grounded no-ship. Lifting herself from the chair, she crossed to the dark window and looked in the direction of the distant landing field. Did they dare risk releasing Duncan from the shielding of that ship? The cell studies said he was a mixture of many Idaho Golas, some descendant of Siona. But what of the taint from the original?
No, he must remain confined.
And what of Mabella? Pregnant Mabella? An honored Matre dishonored?
The Tlilaxu intended for me to kill the imprinter, Duncan said. Will you try to kill the whore?
That was Lucilla's question.
She is not an imprinter, Duncan said.
The council had discussed at length the possible nature of the bonding between Duncan and Mabella. Lucilla maintained there was no bonding at all, that the two remained wary opponents. Best not to risk putting them together. The sexual prowess of the whores would have to be studied at length, though. Perhaps a meeting between Duncan and Mabella in the no-ship could be risked, with careful protective measures, of course. Lastly, she thought about the worm in the no-ship's hold, a worm nearing the moment of its metamorphosis. A small earth-dammed basin filled with mélange awaited that worm. When the moment came, it would be lured out by Shiana into the bath of mélange and water. The resulting sand trout could then begin their long transformation.
You were right, Father. It was so simple when you looked at it clearly.
No need to seek a desert planet for the worms. The sand trout would create their own habitat for Shai Hulud. It was not pleasant to think of Chapter House Planet transformed into vast areas of wasteland, but it had to be done. The last will and testament of Miles Tegg, which he had planted in the no-ship's submolecular storage systems, could not be discredited. Even Belonda agreed to that. Chapter House required a complete revision of all its historical records. A new look had been demanded of them by what Tegg had seen of the Lost Ones, the whores from the Scattering.
You seldom learn the names of the truly wealthy and powerful. You see only their spokesmen. The political arena makes a few exceptions to this, but does not reveal the full power structure.
The Mentat philosopher had chewed deep into everything they accepted, and what he disgorged did not agree with archival dependence upon our inviolate summations.
We knew it, Miles. We just never faced up to it. We're all going to be digging in our other memories for the next few generations.
Fixed data storage systems could not be trusted.
If you destroy most copies, time will take care of the rest.
How the archives had raged at that telling pronouncement by the Basha.
The writing of history is largely a process of diversion. Most historical accounts divert attention from the secret influences around the recorded events.
That was the one that had brought down Belonda. She had taken it up on her own, admitting,
"The few histories that escape this restrictive process vanish into obscurity through obvious processes."
Tegg had listed some of the processes.
Destruction of as many copies as possible, burying the two revealing accounts in ridicule, ignoring them in the centres of education, ensuring that they are not quoted elsewhere, and, in some cases, elimination of the authors.
Not to mention the scapegoat process that brought death to more than one messenger bearing unwelcome news, O'Drade thought.
She recalled an ancient ruler who kept a pike staff handy with which to kill messengers who brought bad news.
We have a good base of information upon which to build a better understanding of our past, O'Drade had argued. We've always known that what was at stake in conflicts was the determination of who would control the wealth or its equivalent.
Maybe it was not a real, noble purpose, but it would do for the time being.
I am avoiding the central issue, she thought.
Something would have to be done about Duncan, Idaho, and they all knew it. With a sigh, O'Drade summoned a thopter and prepared herself for the short trip to the no-ship. Duncan's prison was at least comfortable, O'Drade thought when she entered it. This had been the ship commander's quarters, lately occupied by Miles Tegg. There were still signs of his presence here. A small holostat projector revealing a scene of his home on Lyonnais, the stately old house, the long lawn, the river. Tegg had left a sewing kit behind on a bedside table. The gola sat in a sling chair staring at the projection. He looked up listlessly when O'Drade entered.
You just left him back there to die, didn't you?
Duncan asked.
We do what we must, she said. And I obeyed his orders.
I know why you're here, Duncan said. And you're not going to change my mind. I'm not a damned stud for the witches. You understand me?
O'Drade smoothed her robe and sat on the edge of the bed, facing Duncan.
Have you examined the record my father left for us?
She asked.
Your father?
Miles Tegg was my father. I commend his last words to you. He was our eyes there at the end. He had to see the death on Rakis. The mind at its beginning understood dependencies and key logs.
When Duncan looked puzzled, she explained,
We were trapped too long in the tyrant's oracular maze.
She saw how he sat up more alertly, the feline movements that spoke of muscles well-conditioned to attack.
There is no way you can escape alive from this ship, she said. You know why.
Siona.
You are a danger to us, but we would prefer that you lived a useful life.
I'm still not going to breed for you. Especially not with that little twit from Rakis.
Audrade smiled, wondering how Siona would respond to that description.
You think it's funny?
Duncan demanded.
Not really. But we'll still have Mabella's child, of course. I guess that will have to satisfy us.
I've been talking to Mabella on the comm, Duncan said. She thinks she's going to be a reverend mother, that you're going to accept her into the Bene Gesserit.
Why not? Her cells pass the proof of Siona. I think she will make a superb sister.
Has she really taken you in?
You mean, have we failed to observe that she thinks she will go along with us until she learns our secrets and then she will escape? Oh, we know that, Duncan.
You don't think she can get away from you?
Once we get them, Duncan, we never really lose them.
You don't think you lost the Lady Jessica?
She came back to us in the end.
Why did you really come out here to see me?
I thought you deserved an explanation of the Mother Superior's design. It was aimed at the destruction of Rakis, you see. What she really wanted was the elimination of almost all of the worms.
Great gods below! Why?
They were an oracular force holding us in bondage. Those pearls of the tyrant's awareness magnified that hold. He didn't predict events, he created them.
Duncan pointed toward the rear of the ship.
But what about...
that one? It's just one now. By the time it reaches sufficient numbers to be an influence once more, humankind will have gone its own way beyond him. We'll be too numerous by then, doing too many different things on our own. No single force will rule all of our futures completely. Never again.
She stood.
When he did not respond, she said, within the imposed limits, which I know you appreciate, please think about the kind of life you want to lead. I promise to help you in any way I can.
Why would you do that?
Because my ancestors loved you. Because my father loved you.
Love? You witches can't feel love.
She stared down at him for almost a minute. The bleached hair was growing out dark at the roots and curling once more into ringlets, especially at his neck, she saw.
I feel what I feel, she said. And your water is ours, Duncan Idaho.
She saw the Fremen admonition have its effect on him, and then turned away and was passed out of the room by the guards. Before leaving the ship, she went back to the hold and stared down at the quiescent worm on its bed of Rakian sand. Her viewport looked down from some 200 meters onto the captive. As she looked, she shared a silent laugh with the increasingly integrated Terraza.
We were right, and Shuang Yu and her people were wrong. We knew he wanted out. He had to want that after what he did.
She spoke aloud in a soft whisper, as much for herself as for the nearby observers, stationed there to watch for the moment when metamorphosis began in that worm.
We have your language now, she said.
There were no words in the language, only a moving, dancing adaptation to a moving, dancing universe. You could only speak the language, not translate it. To know the meaning, you had to go through the experience, and even then the meaning changed before your eyes. Noble purpose was, after all, an untranslatable experience. But when she looked down at the rough, heat-immune hide of that worm from the Rakian desert, Audrade knew what she saw. The visible evidence of noble purpose. Softly, she called down to him.
Hey, old worm, was this your design?
There was no answer, but then she had not really expected an answer.
We hope you've enjoyed Heretics of Dune, a Macmillan audiobook from Tor Books. Text copyright 1984 by Herbert Properties, LLC. Production copyright 2008 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.